Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled A Special Relationship, UK and US Trade Deal on the Horizon. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. And today, we are fortunate to have with us our moderator, Wayne Abernathy, who is the chair of a Financial Services and E-Commerce Federalist Society Practice Group, as well as the former Executive Vice President for the American Bankers Association. After our panel has their opening remarks, we will then open up the floor for a live audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Wayne, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, Micah, and thank you to everybody who is listening in to our Teleforum today. Something close to 30 years ago, as the leading trade advocate in the United States, U.S. Senator Phil Gramm called for a free trade agreement between the United States and the United Kingdom. A U.K. opposition leader invoking the European Union's handcuffs that the U.K. wore at the time, which prevented the U.K. from negotiating its own trade agreements, called the idea, quote, barmy, end quote. I had to look up in a dictionary of British slang just what that term means. In Britain, I think it means crazy. Now, after Brexit, the EU handcuffs are off. The idea does not seem so barmy after all. Today, to discuss the U.S.-U.K. trade, we are privileged to have Senator Phil Gramm. Senator Gramm retired from the Senate at the end of 2002, but he did not retire from advocating sound policy. He remains as much a pro-trade advocate as ever. I worked for Senator Gramm for a number of years on trade as well as financial services issues, and I remember he more than once told us, if you want to take on the tough issues, you don't need to worry about stepping on people's toes. They will step aside and push you to the front. Earlier this month, the Wall Street Journal published an op-ed piece co-authored by Senator Gramm together with U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, entitled, U.S. and U.K. Can Set a Standard for Trade. Discussing the idea with Senator Gramm today, we have Matthew Hyman, Senior Fellow and Associate Director for Global Security at the National Security Institute at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. At the Federalist Society, Matthew chairs the Executive Committee of the Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group. Senator Gramm will offer his views on U.S.-U.K. trade. Matthew will then make some comments. And then after a bit of discussion between the two, we will open up the floor for questions from our audience. Senator Gramm, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Wayne. Well, first of all, let me say that it was my great privilege to work with Wayne Abernathy. He ran the banking committee when I was chairman. And he did much good work that made me look good. I had a great staff, and as a result, it made me a good senator and an effective chairman. And I'm very grateful. And I would say to the Federalist Society, you're very fortunate to have Wayne Abernathy, because I don't know anybody who knows more about banking and about central banking than Wayne Abernathy. Let me turn now to the special relationship and to a free trade agreement with the UK. First of all, I guess a good place to start on the special relationship is Bismarck. Bismarck recognized that there was something to this special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. And in fact, he predicted what became the future when he said the most significant event of the 20th century will be the fact that North Americans speak English. But I think the special relationship is more than a common language. I was once speaking at Margaret Thatcher's think tank in London, and she introduced me, and in her introduction, she brought up the special relationship. So I tried to give my take on the special relationship as follows. My people came to America from Prussia. My wife's people came from Korea. But in our heritage and in our hearts, we're British, because it was Britain that taught us to love law and liberty. And that love is the tie that binds. And unfortunately, when I said that, I looked down and tears were streaming down Margaret Thatcher's face. And so I teared up. And so she stood up and looked at me and looked at the audience. And then everybody stood and applauded, and there was wild cheering. And finally, I got recomposed. But obviously, I believe in this special relationship. Now, you would think, given our special relationship, that we would have long ago had a free trade agreement. And while we don't have a free trade agreement, we trade at a very high level together. In goods and services, I think at the last measure, Britain was our fifth largest export market and our seventh largest import market. We have a massive trade in services, but our most significant relationship is in capital transfers. Britain is the number two source for all American investment going abroad. And Britain is the number one source of all private investment coming into America. They've held that position, remarkably enough, since the first settler stepped on American soil at Jamestown, Virginia, in 1607. In fact, it's fair to say that before World War I, capital from Britain and workers from all over the world came to the United States, met, fell in love, and begot the most prosperous nation the world has ever known. And so, for all these reasons, and more, as I will outline very briefly, I think a free trade agreement makes sense. And also, I think we have an opportunity to have a real, honest-to-God free trade agreement and set a standard that's seldom been equaled since the fall of Rome. Now, why do I think that it might be easier to negotiate a free trade agreement with Britain than it is to negotiate a free trade agreement with anybody else? Well, first of all, we already trade a lot, and most of our trade is in services. And I would have to say, in my years as a senator, that I have often seen people virtually breaking the tears, arguing that I needed to protect them from foreign competition. But I've never had anybody come to my office, and Wayne can testify to this, I've never had anybody come in my office and ask me to protect bankers, lawyers, or accountants from foreign competition. They're sort of viewed in the world as consenting adults, and so we already have virtually a free trade area worldwide, except for licensing, in the case of lawyers, which is in many cases an outrage. But what the point I'm making is that most of our trade is an area where there's not a huge political constituency trying to stop it. Also, we don't trade many of the goods that are sensitive politically with Great Britain. And now that they left the EU, we're in a position to negotiate an agreement, and one of the hardest parts of a trade agreement is the part having to do with the rights of the investor, the protection of those rights, a grievance resolution, and a process whereby the foreign investor can get access to real justice. Well, in the case of Britain, our legal system is largely modeled after theirs. We have the two best legal systems in the world. Our property rights are very similar and very strong. And so we have an opportunity to get out of the way an issue that normally makes it difficult to negotiate trade agreements, and that is we can just simply say, if you're an American investor, you invest in Britain, you come under British law. You're a British investor and you invest in America, you come under American law. We just guarantee equal justice. That eliminates a lot of areas where protectionists find loopholes that let them argue for protection. Also, in national security, national security is often the refuge of protectionists. But it's hard to argue that we have any national security issues that put us in conflict with Great Britain. So all those can be swept aside. When you cut down to the bottom line, where is the problem going to come from? Well, fortunately, we don't trade very much in agriculture. 2%, if you look at our service trade balance, our trade in agricultural products is 2% of our trade in services. Tiny. And Britain imports most of its agricultural products from Europe. And so with the opening of a U.S.-UK free trade agreement, agricultural products be more plentiful, cheaper, and British consumers and American producers of agricultural products would probably be the greatest beneficiaries. But there is one area where there's going to be a problem, and that is in meat products, animal products. Because Britain is a significant producer of animal products. In fact, it already is using as an excuse for protection, as all of Europe does, the bleaching of chicken and the use of growth hormones in beef and other animals. And it seems to me that the solution to this problem is to simply rely on the thing that we share in common, love of liberty, and let freedom choose, but let people choose. And the way I would deal with that problem is to simply say, you put the product up for sale, you label it, and then you let the consumer decide. It's amazing that consumers are capable of deciding. And when you let them decide, they tend to choose what is in their best interest. So to sum up, I think that a free trade agreement with Britain makes sense. I think it can set a new standard for the world. I think how the negotiations end will be determined by where they begin. And if they begin with a bunch of little disputes and committees to deal with that issue, we'll end up with a crappy agreement that will be unworthy of either nation. But if we begin with a presumption that we should have trade agreement. Yeah.
We lost you there for just a moment, Senator. So you were just talking about what happened. Yeah, go ahead.
So I can't believe you lost that wisdom I was giving.
I know,
where was
the best part of the speech.
Where was I, Wayne?
You were just talking about the crappy agreement that we end up with if we're not careful.
Yeah, if we're not careful. So in any case, We need to begin with a presumption that we're going to have no quotas, no tariffs, no set-asides, no subsidies, and develop the agreement from there. In fact, President Trump has said that he's for free trade if you have real free trade. Well, this is an opportunity to have real free trade. And so I'm very much for it. I hope we don't miss this opportunity. And I think the well-being of our two countries and the world will be enhanced if we negotiate a true free trade agreement. So that's sort of my thinking on the subject. So, Wayne, let me pass it back to you, and we can begin the discussion and questions when you're ready.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator Graham. Let's turn to Matthew Hyman. Matthew, comments and observations that you have.
Sure. Thanks, Wayne. And thanks to Senator Graham for his comments and the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. This is not going to be a debate. I'm very much in favor of Senator Graham's proposal. I think it makes eminent sense. And I just wanted to point out some of the benefits that could flow from the agreement and maybe extend some of the comments that Senator Graham made. I look at these things, I tend to look at these things from a more of the national security perspective. And so when I think about that, Great Britain is the United States' closest strategic ally in the world, and it has been that since really the end of World War I. And it remains so today. And like any long-term relationship, whether it's with a spouse or with a ally country, there are highs and lows and there are bumps in the road, and we could point to those, but it's been the most durable and consistent relationship since the end of that war. And there's a variety of reasons for that, as Senator Graham has already pointed out. Number one, we share a very similar worldview. It's not identical, but it is extremely similar. We share a very similar view of what major threats to our respective countries are and how they materialize. We share a very similar point of view on issues of law and liberty, as the senator pointed out, but we also share similar points of view on strategy and how we defend our nations. And in particular, if you look at the tables of spending for the United States or Great Britain, compared to most every other nation in the world, we spend significant amounts of money, and rightfully so, on our military and intelligence apparatus, because we believe those things are critical to our respective national security. And so I think when there is an ally like this, that in which we share this common cultural heritage, as Bismarck pointed out and the senator noted, we share a language and we share this long-term trusting relationship and a similar view of the world, the threats, the adversaries that we're going up against. It only makes sense to find opportunities to draw the nations closer together. And I think this free trade vehicle could be a vehicle to do that, in the sense that it should, if it's done the right way, benefit both economies, and with strong economies, then you can have strong national security. And so I'm looking forward to a little bit more discussion, but in sum, I'm very much in favor of it. I'm very interested to hear the senator's thoughts around prospects for such an agreement, perhaps potholes that might be out there on this side of the Atlantic or the other side, and if he's got thoughts on how we could constructively move forward on this proposal. So thanks, Wayne.
Thank you, Matthew. Obviously, I agree with every word you said. I think the danger in the agreement is that there are always strong protectionist elements in American government and American society. Protectionism has been sort of the recessive gene in the American character. And it asserts itself every once in a while. I would say we're in a period today when it has asserted itself very strongly. I would say that while most people around the president or or pro-trade that many of the people that are involved in trade policy in the executive branch are less committed to trade than most of the other senior people in government. I think it's an issue where the president is somewhat conflicted in his thinking. And I think in his mind, since you can't have a real honest-to-goodness free trade agreement, then you've got your interest to promote. And it's hard to define a country, to find a country's interest. Is it in its producers? Is it in its consumers? Very, very difficult to do. And again, as I said in the article, and I'm happy to repeat now, I think if we begin with a presumption that this can be the sort of holy grail of free trade agreements, and that we ought to go for it with it for a totally open free trade agreement, I think that could happen. I think it will be difficult in Britain. I think it will be difficult here. It will take some political courage on both sides of the Atlantic. I think agriculture, even though it's only 2% of our trade, will be a big issue. I think freedom is the answer to it. Just let the consumer decide. But those are the threats I see. Trade is one of those issues that is counterintuitive. Many people see the world in sort of a single entry bookkeeping perspective. If I sold something, I gained. If I bought something, I lost. Or did you buy as much from me as I bought from you? Well, Walmart's never bought anything from me. But yet, I thank God every day when I go to Walmart for Walmart. They benefit me by selling me things, not by buying things from me. And I've always had a view on trade, which is not the normal view. And I admit it. I think it's the right view, but it's not the normal view. And that is, my view is, I'm a free man. What gives government the right to say that I can't buy a legal product that is being produced and sold in the world? Or that I've got to not buy it and buy one made by somebody in the United States because they benefit? That's an abridgment of my freedom. In my mind, there's only one abridgment of free trade that is justifiable, and that's national security. And that is an easy one to distort, believe me. But there are national security elements involved. I think the standards got to be set very high. And don't get me wrong. You know, my dad was a sergeant in the Army. I was born at Fort Benning. I believe in a strong defense. I was on the Armed Services Committee when I started in the Senate. And I'm from the South, and we lost a war. The right side won the war, but nevertheless, the South was occupied. So defense is important to me, but I do think that the argument is abused. So anyway, that's sort of my take on the thing. I'm hopeful, but I know it's going to be hard. And I'm very grateful for Pat Toomey. He is the strongest proponent of trade in Congress today. Now that I'm gone. And he's very courageous on the subject.
Matthew, any comments on any of that?
No, other than to just, you know, I feel like I'm sort of echoing, you know, or preaching to the choir here. I mean, I very much agree with the center. I just think it's critical. Again, as I kind of view it more from the national security side than maybe even the economic side. But I think as we think about the increasing tensions and competition that we're in with China, as we think about sort of lower tier threats like Russia and Iran, to the extent that we can draw our allies closer to us, to the extent that we can enhance our economy, that gives us greater strength in dealing with those threats. And it also, as you know, as the center points out, it also shows the world that the, you know, there are two ways that you can operate in the world as a nation state. And one is as a paranoid, tyrannical regime that operates in an almost mercantilist fashion, or there's the other side of the fence, which happily the United States and the United Kingdom are on, which is more or less free trading nations that believe in the rule of law and liberty. And there are many other Western allies that align with that point of view. And so I think it stands to benefit those countries to try and work together in an enhanced way, because the competition with China is not going to go away anytime soon. And so to the extent that we can find new innovative ways to work together to collectively strengthen economies, that's only going to benefit, you know, the citizens of the U.S., the citizens of the U.K., and if everything aligned, perhaps the citizens of other countries that would see this as a great example for, you know, enhancing their respective economies. And so if we could get a deal struck with the U.K., you could imagine that, you know, as a next tier, you could look to other countries that are part of the Anglosphere, whether it's Australia or Canada or others that have similar cultural alignments, and then go from there. But and that only benefits them as well in competition with China.
Well, the source of power, political and economic and military, is the capacity to produce goods and services. And nobody can argue that trade is not critical for economic development. In fact, the development of the world since World War II has been produced primarily by trade, and we won the Cold War because of our ability to open up world markets and the superiority of our economic system as compared to the Soviet system. So I think, Matthew, this is really a golden opportunity. I hope it's not missed. And I think it's important that that we speak out for it.
Matthew, I think you raised a very interesting point, Senator. Matthew, maybe you want to comment on this some more. You were talking about the impact of a U.S.-UK trade agreement. To the extent that is a successful effort, which I suspect it would be, what impact would that have on our trade relations with the EU? Would they see that as an incentive for them to improve their trade relations, both with the U.S. and with the U.K.?
I don't know. You go ahead, Matthew, then I'll go.
All right. Well, you know, I'd certainly like to think so. I'm a little skeptical of the EU immediately signing up for this kind of model, because I don't think culturally that's where they are. I think it's a more diverse group of countries, obviously, than doing a singular deal with the UK. And that's why I said I thought there might be other countries that would be in line after the UK, before the EU. Australia might be one of those. Canada could be one. Because when I think about the most effective alliance relationships we have, and again, I'm coming to it from the national security side, the most effective alliance relationship we have in the national security sphere is referred to as the Five Eyes Agreement, or the Five Eyes. Well, the Five Eyes, not surprisingly, are all Anglo speaking countries. It's the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And the reason that alliance is so effective is we share a fairly similar view of the world. We share a tremendous amount of intelligence with each other about how to combat the risks we face. And we also share a common cultural heritage, which, as the senator rightly noted, all stems back to England and the rule of law and how we think about liberty and the role of the individual versus the state. So it's no surprise that this alliance, which is fairly low in bureaucracy, there are no standing secretaries that operate the alliance. There's, you know, there are no specific meetings, but it's a very effective alliance. It wouldn't surprise me if those countries might be more interested in signing up to something like this than the EU would be. But obviously, if the EU is interested in trading on these terms, I think we should seriously consider it. But I'll hand it back over to the senator.
Well, look, it's obvious, Matthew, that we think alike. How wise we are, I guess you could debate. But I think almost certainly that if the agreement were reached and if it were a big success, and I would see it being, I think the next place would be Australia, New Zealand. And then I think, you know, the demonstration effect is very powerful economically. So you never know when some country will decide, I need to get in this thing. So I think Europe will be hard. And again, because of, for many reasons, but agriculture being high on the list, especially in places like France, where agriculture there, except in specialty areas, would be very non-competitive as compared to us. But again, they would benefit. Living standards would go up and not down. So, you know, you got to ask yourself, does it make sense to, well, give you an example. I had the milk producer co-op in the U.S. come see me with this wonderful idea that we strengthen their monopoly power and that we raise the price of milk. And so I raised the obvious question. Now, there's something wrong with this picture. The average person in the dairy industry has assets of $1.6 million. That's what it was like when I left the Senate. It's probably higher now. Why in the world would I want to raise the price of the product you produce and force hungry school children to pay it? Why would I ever want to do that? Well, unfortunately, people justify it. But I think that would be the problem. But I agree with Matt. I think other countries would want to join, and there would be aspirational people somewhere, maybe in some little country, nothing country, that just all of a sudden produces a visionary leader who says, why don't we do this? Well, it'd be hard for them to qualify, but if they did, God bless them. So it is important. It's not just for us. It's for the whole world we're talking about. I believe that.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Should we open up the floor now to questions from our listeners?
Absolutely, Wayne. We'll now go to our first question.
Well, good afternoon. Good evening, actually.
Paul, go ahead.
Yes. My name is Tom Lillis. I'm in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. I follow British politics rather closely, so I know where the opposition is in Britain. Could you briefly describe who would be opposed to this free trade deal in the U.S.?
Well, again, one of the reasons I think it's possible is that there are not many natural constituents for opposition to it. We are massive competitors in financial services and legal services and business services. But again, and that would be where you would look first. But again, those products are relatively free traded, except for interchangeability of licensing, which I think should be done in the case of an agreement like this. And again, they're not people that politicians are going to be sensitive to. You know, a banker coming saying, I don't want to compete with a bank in Britain, they're likely to be laughed at. And I also think that, look, if we can't compete with Great Britain, we've got so many advantages. But again, it's not about just producing and selling. It's about benefiting. So I think I don't see from our side as much opposition as I do from the British side. I think on our side, it all depends on how the question is put. I think if the administration said, let's go for a full-blown free trade agreement and not even waste our time on all these other issues, you accept the British legal system when you operate Britain, you accept the American system in America, and on products that there's a dispute about that are legal, label them. I think if that approach were taken, the opposition here would be relatively small. But let me say, Tom, that you have to look at these things with a microscope to find opposition, but there will be opposition. Because there's somebody out there that will see that they could benefit by stopping it. And even though thousands of others benefited, they will oppose it. And if we're not careful, they'll be successful. And I'll just give you a worldwide example. Sugar. We pay twice the world price for sugar. We pay twice the world price in the United States, and there are 88,000 consumers for every one producer in America. Now you ask yourself, how in the name of God did that happen? And how is it perpetuated? And the answer is, small groups that care immensely about an issue when nobody else is paying attention can exert tremendous influence. So that's why we don't want to get down in the damn weeds here. We want to stay on the basic principles and just plow over that. But there will be opposition, I can assure you. Britain doesn't produce sugar, fortunately, which is why even from the Middle Ages, they dominated the baking industry because everybody else in Europe produced sugar and they subsidized it. And Britain could buy it cheap, and so they sold everybody crackers and cookies.
Matthew, any comments on that question?
No, although I would ask Senator Graham, you know, understanding that you are a former U.S. politician, but obviously you have a lot of experience sizing up politicians. What's your assessment of perhaps Prime Minister Johnson's appetite for something like this? Do you think he would be interested?
Yeah, I think he would be interested. Now, let me make it clear. I really don't know him. But I know, first of all, he has a first-rate mind. I heard him debate once, a debate of the virtues of Greece and Rome. And so in terms of his highest aspirations, I don't see how he could not be a free trader. Now, where your heart is very important, but things happen that put your faith to the test. I'd been in the Senate about 3 months, and there was a proposal to impose a protective tariff on oil. And I was from the biggest, maybe Alaska was bigger, but hell, we don't count Alaska. I'll go ahead and say the biggest oil producing state in the country. Now that's where your values get put to the test. So I did a quick gut check on it and decided I didn't want to have to explain to my grandchildren how grandpa was a protectionist. So I led the opposition and killed the protective tariff for oil. And, people in Houston call me the the third senator from Massachusetts, but I survived it. You got to be willing to go out and explain to people that Texas consumes more oil than it produces. We're the largest consumer of petrochemicals of any state in the union. At one time, half of the world's petrochemicals were produced at a crescent from Corpus Christi to Beaumont. But it was a hard sell, and there was hard feelings about it. But now, whether the prime minister is stand up to the animal products industry, I don't know. It'll be a hard choice, but look, he's got a solid majority. He's in office for 5 years. Someone who thinks the Greeks were better than the Romans, something right with him. So I'm hopeful. In terms of President Trump, it's hard to know. I just don't know. I think if the pitch were made early and right, let's do it the right way and see if it could be done, it might work. It might work. It would certainly be a chance to show that in a real honest-to-God free trade agreement, he's not a protectionist. But I hope he takes the opportunity.
Micah, do we have other callers wishing to ask questions?
Yes, we do. We'll go ahead and move to our next caller.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Steve Dewey. I'm in Arlington, Virginia. And first of all, I'd like to thank TEDSOC for sponsoring this. And Wayne, thanks for moderating. My question to Senator Graham and to Matthew, whenever Brexit finally gets done, do you think that that may trigger an exodus of other countries leaving the EU? And if so, and I guess related to that, you mentioned the five I countries. Do you think there's maybe two or three other countries that would also be candidates to want to pursue a free trade agreement with the United States?
Well, let me say that I think Europe's fear when Britain left was that other countries should follow. I don't think that's the case. Britain never adopted the euro. And most European countries benefit from the European bureaucracy because their own governments are worse. But Britain didn't. So I don't know that other countries will follow. My guess is they won't, at least initially. Now, there obviously is a big debate going on in Europe right now about whether or not to issue bonds that are the debt of the EU to bail out, especially some of the southern European countries. And now that's another issue, and that could be explosive. But, and if I were in Germany, I sure wouldn't be for it. But so I don't think the EU breaks up. And let me stop. I talked too long on the last one. Go ahead, Matthew.
Well, I tend to agree. I don't think the EU is going to break up anytime near term. But I am mindful of the fact that when it comes to asking individual citizens of these countries, the popularity of the EU is not nearly what it is amongst the political, bureaucratic, ruling class of Europe. And so examples of that are several years ago when France had a vote on the revised EU treaty, it was a close vote. And when countries have had the opportunity to vote on things related to enhancing the EU's power, the citizens look at it much more skeptically than European politicians do. And also in some areas, particularly in the national security space, culturally, individual European government leadership tends to take a different view on national security questions than does the EU bureaucracy. For example, President Macron of France has a very consistent view of France's role in the world, in particular in Africa, and being highly engaged and being very active in counterterrorism in a way that I don't think the EU bureaucracy is. And I think he takes a more hawkish view on a number of issues. So there is always this underlying friction between individual citizens of these countries and the EU bureaucracy. And there's also a sort of a layer of friction between, you know, country leadership and the EU bureaucracy when it comes to national security questions. So I think I wind up where the senator does, which is I don't anticipate it breaking up anytime soon, but there are those fissures that could crack wider at any given time, particularly in moments of crisis.
Mike, I think we're ready for the next question.
Well, we've actually exhausted the questions for now, Wayne, so I'll offer instructions again. If anyone has a question, you can jump right to the front of the queue if you press star and then pound. And in the meantime, Wayne, I'll toss it back over to you for anything else you wanted to discuss.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I do have a question that's been sort of burning in my mind here, frankly, in preparation for this teleform, and I'd love to have the senators and Matthew's view on it. And is this, in the 1930s is an age when, as a nation, we doubled and tripled down on bad economic policies. We followed a policy to reduce trade. How significant can removing barriers to U.S.-UK trade be for the U.S. in this current economic condition? Can the very initiation of trade expansion negotiations with the U.K. help to stimulate economic activity? That's my question.
Yeah, I think it can. I don't think it's a miracle cure. And it's very difficult to measure because the benefits will come principally to consumers in terms of ability to buy products cheaper. And it's hard to aggregate all that stuff. But I think it would be a very important step now, especially in a world that is becoming more protectionist. And one of the things that's scary to me is that protectionist arguments are present in both political parties. And there are not many people who are willing to stand up on the issue. And there's nothing more dangerous than a just cause that has no valid spokesman. So I think that it would be important, Wayne, in the value it brings, but in the symbolism it brings. In the midst of a world where people are talking about protectionism, two great nations, the world's two greatest trading nations, have reached a total free trade agreement. I think the demonstration effect of that would be extraordinarily positive, especially when people started to see in coming years the benefits from it.
Matthew, any comments on that?
No, other than I agree with the center's point of view on that. And I also think related to sort of demonstrating U.S. engagement, in trade, in a similar vein, there are members of both parties that are advocating for sort of a lessened role for the United States and the world on the national security front. And I certainly don't believe that the U.S. is able to solve all the world's ills, nor should it try to do so. But I do believe that when the U.S. is engaged in the world, security is better for the U.S. and security is better for the world because the U.S. helps to operate a framework of interactions amongst nations that is rules-based, and that is generally a good thing for the world. And so to the extent that the U.S. can further engage with like-minded countries on trade and on national security, I think, the world's citizens benefit from that, and we should look to do more of that, not less.
Wayne, let me add to that. It didn't take me long when I got into Congress and in the Senate to figure out that power was not what it was cracked up to be. That it is a burden. And that we expend treasure and blood all over the world, and very seldom is it appreciated. But in the end, you have to ask yourself, if we're not going to lead the world, who are you willing to turn it over to? And while I certainly did not want to undertake many of these burdens, where a good conscience, as President Kennedy said, is your only sure reward, I never could figure out who I was willing to let do it other than us. And so as a result, I always supported doing it. But I wasn't happy about it. So I do think it's something we have to keep in mind. If the world would go away, if we, you know, if there were no challenges, no threats, we could, you know, as proponents of domestic spending say, you know, we could spend this money on housing for poor people somewhere, or we could, that we're spending on defense. But the problem is, if we don't protect freedom, who's going to?
Very good. Micah, any, further questions?
No other questions still, Wayne, so you still have the floor.
Well, I have one more I'd like to put to the senator and to Matthew, and then give each of you some time to sum up. And the question is this. I have been disturbed by efforts in recent years to take good trade promotion agreements and burden them with efforts to impose labor and environmental agendas, which can actually disrupt trade and weaken improvements in labor and environmental conditions. To what extent is that a risk in these negotiations?
Well, I think we can prevent it from being a risk by just, there's no reason in dealing with Britain that labor issues should exist or environmental issues should exist. Because, again, they share these same concerns, these same values, which is one of the reasons I think that it would be easier to negotiate a free trade agreement. And one of the fears that I have always had and have today as I watch this process of these issues becoming more prominent is that they will become a vehicle for imposing restrictions on your country. Look, I don't mind saying that the renegotiation with Mexico has some rotten provisions, requiring them to pay wages that will make their manufacturing non-competitive, strengthening unions in Mexico, and denying American businesses dispute resolution in Mexico so they won't invest there, as if we are indifferent about the well-being of our neighbor. We're the only rich country in the world with a poor neighbor. A poor neighbor hurts your property value. So I think your concern is very real. And again, I think this is an agreement that wouldn't need those issues and shouldn't have them. But I'm very concerned that we're going to have, and I think there's a real effort underway to do it, to write trade agreements that require standards that we're not meeting in our own country and then impose them on ourselves through a trade agreement.
Well, thank you, Senator. This has been an excellent, excellent discussion. Just a couple final words then for each of you. Matthew, let's turn to you for a few concluding remarks, and then we'll turn to the senator for his concluding remarks, and then I think we will be at the top of the hour. So go ahead, Matthew.
Well, I want to thank you, Wayne, for moderating, and I certainly want to thank Senator Graham for agreeing to share some time with us to talk about this proposal. As the listeners understand at this point, I'm very much in favor of it. I hope there are constituencies within the Trump administration that are giving serious thought to this, because I think, as I've said before, it would obviously be good for our economy. It would be good for our national security, and it could be an excellent exemplar to the rest of the world as to how you can interact with each other in a mutually beneficial way. So with that, I'll hand it over to the senator.
Well, let me just conclude by thanking the Federalist Society. Our Constitution was written by people who knew the English language better than we do. And you've got, I think if you're going to have a real constitution, you've got to take the context in which they said it and what they actually said and take it seriously. And this idea that we can impose values that sort of well up through court decisions is alien to the constitutional system and to what the founders believed. And I very much appreciate what the Federalist Society has done in terms of promotion of the Constitution as it is written. If we want to change it, there's a process for changing it. And it needs changing in some areas. I'd like to have a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, but it's not up to a court to make that decision. Finally, I used to say to judges that I recommended to the president, look, don't get caught up in this deal about not wanting to infringe on legislative power. If the Constitution says something as bright as the morning sun, pick up the sword and use it. Amen. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Senator. I think this has been a wonderful discussion, and I'm looking forward to many people listening to it who weren't listening to it now on the podcast. Micah, the floor is back to you.
All right. Thank you, Wayne. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank all of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.